This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are very excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's jump right into it, and let's start with Israel-Palestine. And could you tell us about these detainee exchanges that happened on Thursday?
Sure. This actually goes back to Sunday when there was a regularly scheduled detainee exchange. They're going on weekly. Saturday, Sunday, I should say. They're going on every weekend. Saturday is the day when they're supposed to be happening, where Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other factions release a number of October 7th hostages. The Israelis release a number of Palestinian detainees, and the ceasefire or the truce, whatever you want to call it, continues for another week. This past weekend, Hamas and company released 4 female IDF soldiers. As you would expect, I guess. But the Israeli government complained. Apparently, there is a woman or was a woman civilian or considered a civilian who was still being held by Hamas or Islamic Jihad, I think actually was the group technically holding her. And she was scheduled to be released. She should have been released under the terms of the truce agreement. She should have been released prior to any soldiers being released, but she was not part of this exchange over the weekend. And so, as I say, the Israelis reacted angrily to this, and they wound up delaying the opening of the roads, the north-south roads in Gaza for people who have been displaced to southern Gaza to return to what's left of their homes in northern Gaza, which is also supposed to be part of the truce. They wound up holding that up, leaving tens of thousands of people just sort of stranded in central Gaza waiting for these checkpoints to open. So this prompted some furious negotiations to try and salvage the agreement. And what happened was Hamas agreed to an extra exchange of detainees that would take place midweek, and that took place on Thursday. The civilian Arbel Yehud was among those released, along with 2 other Israeli October 7th hostages. They also wound up releasing 5 Thai nationals, foreign workers, basically, who were taken on October 7th as well. The Israelis released 110 Palestinian detainees. Thursday's exchange was apparently problematic as well. It took place in 2 phases. There was a soldier who was released in northern Gaza to the Israeli military, and then there were the 2 civilian Israelis were released in Khan Yunis, apparently with a crowd of people, spectators, civilians gathered that turn out to be somewhat unruly. There's video of Yehud, the woman who was released, kind of being ushered through this crowd by Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters and looking very harried and like she was being pressed. And that drew another angry response from the Israeli government, which then delayed its own release of detainees while it demanded guarantees from Hamas and company that this sort of thing would not happen again. I guess they were satisfied and the exchange went forward. But this is, you know, I think highlights how fragile this agreement is. The wrong name on a list or an unexpected person not being included in exchange or being included or whatever. Just a video that shows things, you know, maybe not going exactly according to plan could be enough to upset the whole apple cart. So still a very sensitive period, but so far everything is going okay. It's Saturday is supposed to be another exchange. Another three Israelis will be released, and so we'll see what happens.
And should something like that happen, then it leads. What is the Trump administration going to do if something upsets the apple cart and Israel tries to basically break the ceasefire? What would Trump do? I guess remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would probably lean on the Israelis to hold on to this first phase as long as nothing egregious happens. Like, the, you know, if it's just something like a miscommunication in the exchange or, you know, a crowd that and the video that from Thursday shows, like, you know, these militant fighters kind of holding the crowd back. I mean, they weren't, you know, allowing them to disrupt things, but they were pretty harried, it looks like. So if it was something like that, I think the administration would lean on Israel to maintain the truce, because this is, after all, Donald Trump's. It's been kind of given, you know, the imprimatur of Donald Trump. Steve Witkoff, his envoy, was by, you know, many accounts instrumental in getting to a deal, and Trump has bragged about it. He's owned it. For it to fall apart in this first phase, he's sort of washed his hands now of whether, you know, in terms of whether it will get to a second phase or a third phase, that he's not sure. He's, you know, doesn't feel very optimistic about it, that type of language. But this first phase, this first 6-week period that's, you know, kind of in the agreement, in writing, I think he would really like to see that play out, because it burnishes his reputation, or the reputation he wants to claim as a peacemaker. That's, you know, that sort of thing.
So let's move east to the West Bank. What about the IDF operation happening there?
The IDF has killed at least 17 people in just Jenin. There have been, you know, several other deaths in the West Bank since the ceasefire in Gaza went into effect. They began an operation in Jenin almost as the ceasefire was coming to effect in Gaza, almost literally, you know, in the same moment. They have surrounded the Jenin refugee camp. They've attacked medical facilities. Very Gaza-like operation that the IDF is carrying out here in Jenin. As I say, they've killed at least 17 people. The Israelis, I think, are claiming they were all militants, but I know of at least one 2-year-old child they killed in a village just outside Jenin by firing blindly into a house. So, you know, clearly not all militants, not all terrorists, to use the Israeli parlance. It's unclear how much longer this operation is going to continue. Israel Katz, the prime minister, or the defense minister, the defense minister of Israel, toured the Jenin refugee camp on Wednesday and basically said the IDF is going to be here for the foreseeable future inside the camp. He said, ensure that terrorism does not return. You know, take that for what you will, but it does sound like this is going to be a long-term presence, at least in Jenin. As I say, there have been other incidents in Tulkarm and Tubas, other parts of the northern West Bank, which really seems to be the focus, but Jenin has taken the worst of it by far.
Thank you, Derek. And let's talk about the humanitarian situation.
This is becoming another point of contention in terms of the ceasefire in Gaza. There's a couple of things to be concerned about here. One is that Hamas is saying that the Israelis are kind of going back on agreements that were made to allow more or less construction type materials to get into the territory in the first, you know, early days of the truce, and not, you know, like heavy construction. We're not rebuilding any homes or structures, but there are still hundreds of thousands of people living in tents that are not really meant for long-term occupation. So the idea was to bring in more durable materials to build stronger displaced person shelters. And that doesn't seem to be happening. And the complaint is that the Israelis are blocking that stuff from getting in, even though they said they would allow it. So that's one area of concern. Overall, the effort looks like it's still going. You know, hundreds of trucks are getting into the territory every day. You know, this is a market and welcome change from the way things were prior to the truce going into effect. But the other area of concern is that the Israeli ban on the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, has gone into effect. It was supposed to go into effect this week, and the Israelis are abiding by it, which has forced they're forcing UNRWA to shut down its offices in East Jerusalem. And effectively, they can't ban it from operating in Gaza, but they can make it impossible for the organization to function in Gaza by making it, you know, impossible for it to function in Israel. So that you know, the fallout from that remains to be seen. I mean, UNRWA is responsible for distributing aid once it gets into Gaza. They are still on the ground, the only presence in Gaza doing that. The United Nations has not made any effort to transition that function to another agency or to hand it off to an outside group, largely, I think, to avoid setting the precedent where a UN member state feels comfortable expelling a UN organization. This is not something that, as a member state, you're supposed to be allowed to do. And the United Nations doesn't want to create the precedent that it's okay, which I guess is noble, but you know, it's going to probably be gonna have a very deleterious effect on the humanitarian operation in Gaza. We don't know how deleterious yet, because the ban, as I say, just went into effect this week. But I think you could see very quickly some things start to go very badly.
Thank you, Derek. And let's talk. We have in the notes, Trump floats ethnic cleansing, and it's so grim that we live in a world where we're talking about floating ethnic cleansing, like floating an idea. But I actually think it's really crucial, because I think Trump's opinion on this is what a lot of people in authority actually think. And I think he is just expressing what a lot of people have assumed is going to happen, just in his typical blunt, vulgar terms. So what has Trump said?
On Saturday, Trump told reporters that he would like to see Arab countries, and he singled out Egypt and Jordan, take in essentially the population of Gaza as refugees. He did allow for the idea that it could be either temporary or long term. You know, guess which one of those is likely to come to pass. And, you know, he reiterated it actually later in the week, after both the governments of Egypt and Jordan said, hell no, we're not doing that. And Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is a Trump guy. I mean, they were, you know, they had a pretty good relationship during the first Trump administration. Sisi just in general is the kind of guy that gets along with Donald Trump, right wing, you know, handsome general type guy. I don't know about handsome, but general at least. And yet he, you know, outright said this is not something that we're going to be a part of, both for national security reasons and because it's a monstrous idea. So, you know, both countries that he singled out have said thanks, but no thanks. And the concern, I think, more for Jordan than Egypt, is not just that you would be countenancing ethnic cleansing and sort of, you know, giving in to Israeli pressure, but for Jordan to take in another large number of Palestinians could be politically destabilizing in a kingdom that's already not the most stable political entity in the world. So, you know, there's a lot of domestic reasons why they wouldn't want to do this, in addition to the principled one that they don't want to suborn ethnic cleansing. But Trump repeated it again kind of midweek that this is what he wants to see happen. And I think you're right. It's what the establishment thinks is probably going to happen anyway. There's no end game here. There's no Palestinian state at the end of this, because the United States has given Israel veto over that. And so the only resolution here that doesn't leave a permanent state of apartheid and you know, keep these people permanently in bondage is that they go somewhere else. And you frame it not as ethnic cleansing, but as voluntary relocation or whatever, you know, euphemism you want to come up with. And Trump even framed it as like, you know, Gaza's unlivable and, you know, people have been you know, so badly treated and, you know, had to live hard lives. Wouldn't it be nice if they could go somewhere else and have a more stable, peaceful existence?
I think a lot of people in power think that.
You know, at the end of the day, it's ethnic cleansing. I mean, you know, let's call it what it is.
No, it's absolutely ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
100%.
But they do, I think they do this dance to make it sound nicer than that. You know, I don't think it's going to go anywhere because I don't know what he could offer as inducements to get countries to go along with it. And somebody's got to go along with it. I mean, it can't just be that the U.S. wants to, unless the U.S. is taking them in, which something tells me the Trump administration not going to be willing to do that. Then you got to find somebody else to dance with. And I'm not sure that there's anybody. I mean, there was that rumor that Steve Witkoff had talked about moving them to Indonesia. The Indonesian government said, we haven't heard anything about this. That's very interesting. We're not really going to comment on it. But, you know, it's just like shots in the dark. And I think to some extent reflects the lack of sophistication maybe on the part of the people that Donald Trump has working for him and Trump himself. That again, it's sort of like taking the mask off, but it's a very imperialist viewpoint that we can just move people around on a map and it doesn't matter where they go. We just tell them, hey, these people are coming to your country, tough shit, deal with it, and it'll happen. And, you know, of course that's not the case, but they don't really grasp that, I think.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Lebanon, where the IDF has skipped the withdrawal deadline.
Yes. I'm sure this comes as a huge surprise to you as it did to me, but the IDF failed to meet its Sunday deadline to withdraw from southern Lebanon. So shock of shocks, under the ceasefire agreement that it struck with Hezbollah in late November, it was supposed to leave southern Lebanon, have completed its withdrawal. It has not done that. It's now talking about staying for, I think they asked the Trump administration, which is now, you know, is inherited from the Biden administration, the job of arbitrating this ceasefire, that they asked for another 3-week extension to February 18th. The Trump administration granted it and the Lebanese government went along because really what choice does it have? I don't expect that the IDF is going to make that deadline either. We'll probably just keep stalling and stalling. The question is, how much longer can you stall before the ceasefire breaks altogether and you've got fighting again? Who knows? On Sunday, there was a spate of violence across southern Lebanon as a number of people who were attempting to return home, thinking naively, I guess, that the Israelis were leaving and that it was okay to go back home. A number of them, the Israelis fired upon them. They killed, I think, 22 people, or actually may have been a couple more than that. They killed 26 people, according to the Lebanese media, over 2 days, Sunday and Monday, far more on Sunday than Monday. So I guess the message was sent when they gunned down all those people on Sunday. Don't try to go home because it's not safe yet. But that's where things stand with this sort of now limbo status of semi-permanent, but we're going to keep pretending that it's a temporary occupation of southern Lebanon, and we'll see how long that can survive.
Let's stay in the region and talk about the political transition happening in Syria.
There were a number of announcements that the Syrian government made on Wednesday, kind of signposting the political transition. The biggest was probably that Ahmed Ashara, the former, now former head of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, officially Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, no longer officially exists. It's been absorbed into the Syrian state. But his position was made semi-official, at least. He's no longer the de facto leader of Syria. He is the transitional president. Now, how he was chosen transitional president, other than somebody wrote it on a piece of paper and filed it somewhere, I don't know. There was certainly no political process that brought him to that office. But nevertheless, he now has the title which I guess is probably useful from a diplomatic perspective as he meets with other, you know, leaders, world leaders, to try and get sanctions relief and other things, you know, get Syria's new government accepted into the world community to the extent that he wants to do that. The government also announced that it's suspending the constitution, which it had to do, I think, to name Shara's president, dissolving parliament. These are all expected parts of the political transition. It dissolved, as I said, Hayat al-Hisham, as well as all other military factions in the country, some of whom I think were probably surprised to hear that they'd been dissolved, because they haven't really completed their negotiations with this new government, like the Syrian Democratic Forces. There are some factions in southern Syria that are not yet ready to lay down their arms. But nevertheless, on a legal sense, they dissolved all of these factions and integrated them supposedly into state security institutions. Also, the Ba'ath Party, I know, Danny, you're a big Ba'ath head, also dissolved. Yeah, rest in peace to them. It's the end of an era. So yeah, that's all kind of, you know, in the line or in the realm of political transition. That's what's been going on.
So we just talked about the IDF being in southern Lebanon. It turns out that the IDF is also in southern Syria. So Derek, tell us about that.
Yes, Israel Katz, again, the Israeli defense minister, said on Tuesday that the temporary IDF occupation of southern Syria, and you recall when the Bashar al-Assad government was ousted last month, the Israelis moved into the 1974 buffer zone that was created by United Nations agreement, moved into that, and then went a bit beyond, particularly around the Golan region, that the Israelis are staying there indefinitely. Previously, they had said, well, it's going to be a temporary occupation for security reasons, might take a year, we might be out by the end of 2025. No, that's probably not going to happen now. It's indefinite. This includes Mount Hermon, which is the highest point in the region, is on the Syrian, the peak of it is on the Syrian side of the Golan, and is a obviously strategic piece of real estate that the Israelis covet. So they have taken it, and they will be sitting there for the indefinite future, I guess. This buffer zone was, of course, taken to protect the Israeli-occupied portion of the Golan, which itself is Syrian territory that was occupied as a buffer zone in 1967. They have now a buffer zone for the buffer zone, and I'm sure there will be another buffer zone for that buffer zone that we get somewhere down the road, but we'll have to wait and see for that.
Thank you, Derek. And let's talk about Russia. We thought Russia was a fake friend, but it turns out that Russia is actually a friend to the government in Syria. So what's been going on there?
Well, we don't know yet. We don't know if they're friends yet. We do know that the Russian government has been negotiating with the new authorities in Damascus about the status of Russia's two military bases in northwestern Syria. These are very important to the Russian military for power projection into the Mediterranean, for, you know, status as foreign bases. This, you know, signifies great power status. You know, for a number of reasons, they would like to hold on to these things, even though the new authorities may not be so amenable to that as Bashar al-Assad was. But there have been negotiations. The Russians haven't really commented on what's been discussed, except to say that they've been frank conversations with the Syrians. What I've seen reported is that the Syrians basically have offered to let the Russians keep the bases, but they want some very specific things in return. One, they want Bashar al-Assad, who is now living in exile in Russia, to be returned to Syria, presumably to stand trial. They want reparations payments from Russia. And they probably, although I haven't seen this reported quite so explicitly, but I would imagine they want some Russian assistance in terms of standing up what's left of the old Syrian military, which is uses a lot of Russian, older Russian Soviet equipment. So they probably want some technical assistance in that regard as well. And there are other, you know, infrastructure things in Syria that were built by the Soviets that could, you know, they presumably would like technical assistance with those things as well. You know, as I say, the Russians haven't commented, so it's unclear where their red lines are here. Do I think that they would hand Assad back over to Syria in return for keeping those bases? Probably. The reparations payments are probably a bigger, more sensitive thing than Assad, not to, you know, not that I don't believe that he and Vladimir Putin are just the best of friends, but you know, I suspect he's a little more fungible than the money that they would be asked to pay.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thanks, Derek. This is, we're thinking about doing an episode on this, but I think we're just going to talk about it now, which is, of course, the DeepSeek rollout and how that affected the stock market, U.S.-China relations, all those good things.
I mean, we should still do an episode because I don't know what the hell any of this means. But yeah, there was the revelation of the new Chinese-made artificial intelligence program, DeepSeek, which proved so, I guess, disruptive to the market. It's open source. It doesn't, apparently doesn't cost as much as the billions, hundreds of billions of dollar AI models that are being kind of bandied about by Silicon Valley in an effort to, you know, get more government funding and all kinds of nice cash. This one does not cost that much. It's open, as I said, it's open source. It created quite a stir, and on Monday that manifested as a crash in tech stocks, especially Nvidia, the chip maker, lost a lot of value. Now that it didn't continue. There was I think some fear on Monday that this was the beginning of a bubble burst, and that doesn't appear to have happened. Nevertheless, you could say, you know, the tech world is in a bit of a tizzy now over this this program. It indicates that the gap that was perceived to exist between China and the U.S. on AI and basically tech overall probably doesn't exist. That the last four
certainly
years,
not to the same degree,
right? That the last 4 years of the Biden administration has been, you know, kind of trying to do this mild decoupling and putting export controls on advanced chips going to China has not worked to prevent China from developing this technology. And in fact, it seems it's probably backfired because it's forced Chinese engineers to be more innovative to get around the fact that they couldn't get a hold of these advanced chips. So, you know, not a great statement about the foreign policy of the Biden administration. And yeah, basically kind of shaking up the tech world in terms of who's on top and who's, you know, how far ahead is the United States, if at all. So as I say, I think we should definitely do an episode on this, but those are the basics, I guess.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Sudan and this string of military successes around Khartoum.
This is interesting. I mean, we've talked about the Sudanese military has had some recent, you know, a recent run of success. They captured, the biggest part of that was they captured the city of Wad Madani, which had been taken over by the Rapid Support Forces Group, which is located in kind of central Sudan's Jazeera state. That was a major development. On Friday and kind of into the weekend, they achieved a number of major victories around Khartoum. Now, the situation around Khartoum prior to that was the military controlled most of the city of Omdurman, but Khartoum itself was still a battleground, and the RSF controlled a lot of Bakri, or Khartoum North, as it's sometimes known, the third city in this in the kind of capital area triumvirate of urban areas. But the military moved in, as I say, kind of late last week. It seized, the first thing it took was the Jaili oil refinery, which is the largest oil refinery in Sudan and located kind of just north of the capital region, and then was able to move into Bahri and retake its Signal Corps headquarters, which had been occupied by the RSF. It was then able to move further south into Khartoum itself and break the RSF siege of the military headquarters in Khartoum, which had been in place virtually since this conflict began in April 2023. So some very quick and somewhat stunning developments there. Now, it hasn't been, to my knowledge, hasn't been followed up by any big new developments since the weekend. But nevertheless, I think you have to say that this conflict, which seemed to be, all the momentum seemed to be behind the RSF as recently as just a few months ago, that's no longer the case. The situation in Darfur is unchanged. The RSF still controls almost the entirety of that region, every major city except Al-Fashir, which is still besieged. And you've got, you know, drone strikes killing dozens of people and you know, famine and very terrible things happening there. But in other parts of the country, it does seem like the military is on the move all of a sudden, which you know, could be attributed to an influx of weapons, could be attributed to the defection of some RSF commanders. There's any number of things that could be playing out here, but it does seem there's momentum on the military side now.
Let's go to the DRC and talk about M23, which has taken Goma and has started to advance south.
M23 moved into Goma, it seems, kind of over the weekend. It issued a claim, I think, late Sunday that it had taken the city and was giving the remaining Congolese security forces there a few hours to surrender. That, as far as I can tell, I don't know how many of them did. Some of them certainly did, but there were still reports of fighting in Goma, kind of scattered here and there over Monday, Tuesday. By Wednesday, it seemed the city was pretty much under control, but there were still reports of fighting on the outskirts to the north of Goma. The airport is under M23 control. It's really M23 and the Rwandan military at this point. I think there were reports of hundreds of regular Rwandan soldiers having moved across the border into Goma, participating in this. But the city itself seems to be more or less under M23 control. Details in terms of casualties are impossible to come by. There are reports of, you know, there are some casualty figures based on hospital records, but a lot of dead people in the streets, it sounds like, who never got to a hospital. So counting how many people were killed or even wounded is has been very difficult. Aid agencies that have a presence in Goma are still trying to kind of ascertain what the situation is. With the airport under control, that makes it very difficult to bring in any sort of humanitarian relief. And yes, as you said, Danny, they've now, M23 has now moved out of Goma. They've captured, I think on Wednesday, there were reports that they captured three towns in South Kivu province. Now, Goma is the capital of North Kivu. It lies at on the southern part of North Kivu province. South Kivu is, you know, has hitherto, you know, escaped most of this latest, you know, uprising by M23, but they have taken three towns, as far as I know, on Wednesday, and they were moving toward the city of Bukavu, which is the capital of South Kivu province. It's located on the southern end of Lake Kivu, which is the common you know, body of water between these two provinces, and Goma's on the north end and Bukavu's on the southern end. So that city may be under threat at this point as well. The diplomacy here has been pretty non-existent. There was an emergency meeting of the East African community on Wednesday, where the hope was that Felix Tshisekedi, the president of the DRC, and Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, which is, as I say, backing and probably participating in this M23 operation, the hope was that they would meet and maybe there could be some, you know, discussion of a ceasefire or something. Tshisekedi skipped the meeting altogether. He stayed in the DRC, gave an address where he promised a military response that would take back all of this territory, which is fairly absurd, I think, at this point, to think that the Congolese military can reverse what's happened. So there's been no direct communication between Rwanda and the DRC. There've been calls from Western governments, France, the UK, the US, for a ceasefire, and a lot of that has been directed at Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. The problem is for the West is that Rwanda has been a very useful ally, tool, proxy, whatever you want to call it, client for Western governments for a while now. And so nobody's really all that keen on challenging Kagame or punishing him, if you want to put it in those terms. The UK, for example, has talked about reassessing that aid, and yet You know, they're still trying to, I mean, there was a hope at one point that they would be able to use Rwanda as a dumping ground for asylum seekers. That was foiled by the courts. But nevertheless, Rwanda is still an important piece of the UK's kind of Africa policy or African diplomacy. So, you know, whether they would be willing to go as far as cutting Kagame off is hard to imagine. So that's where things stand. It's hard to see any reversal to this anytime soon, barring a ceasefire. M23 just seems to be on the move, and the Congolese military is incapable of mounting a response.
Thanks, Sarek. And we're going to have an episode on that as well, correct?
Yes, we should have an episode on that fairly soon.
Great. Let's talk about Ukraine and particularly Putin's comments on the peace talks or potential peace talks.
Well, Vladimir Putin, as you know, is keenly concerned with the rule of law in Ukraine. He's always been, you know, very concerned with this sort of thing. And so, with all the talk about potentially holding peace talks, and is Donald Trump going to try to arrange something? You know, what may happen in the next few months? Putin suggested on Tuesday that it would be illegal for his government to hold peace talks with Volodymyr Zelensky. And this is because Zelensky canceled last year's presidential election. So according to Putin, he's outlived his mandate as president, is no longer the legitimate head of state of Ukraine. So you can't have peace talks with him. It would have to be done. He did speculate about what could be a legal way to hold peace talks. Maybe the speaker of the Ukrainian parliament, who's first in line in succession, could lead the peace talks. He was offering some suggestions. And I think it's great that he's so worried about the integrity of the Ukrainian government. I can't even get through this with a straight face. It seems like, you know, just an attempt to kind of throw a monkey wrench into the process here if you're going to negotiations. Yeah, he's kind of dunking a little bit, trying to delay any sort of diplomacy, yeah, that sort of thing. It's a little trolling, I guess, on his part.
Let's talk about this Colombia-U.S. spat over deportation flights.
Right. On Sunday, the U.S., the Trump administration was set to send two U.S. military planes carrying Colombian deportees to Colombia. And the government of Colombia, the president, Gustavo Petro, refused to accept those flights. Donald Trump had what I think could generously be described as a conniption fit. He announced a whole bunch of penalties that he was going to impose on Colombian officials, travel bans, that he announced he was going to impose a 25% tariff on all Colombian imports that would rise to 50% within a week. Petro announced some retaliatory measures, his own tariff, for example, but then explained his decision as one that was focused on the dignity of the deportees and the idea that the way that the Trump administration is handling these deportations, which are no different, really. I mean, for all the talk of like mass roundups, we haven't really seen that yet in the U.S. And these deportation flights were happening under Joe Biden. It's a regular thing that takes place. But the way that the Trump administration has been doing it is to sort of maximize the humiliation suffered by the deportees. So they're put on military aircraft. They're shackled, legs and hands, just treated like criminals, which is you could say, shall we say, a bit inappropriate and certainly undignified. And that was the comment that Petro made. Now, by Monday, this had all sort of blown over. They had come to an agreement where the Colombian government sent its own planes to the U.S. to pick up these deportees, who then got presumably more dignified treatment on the Colombian planes than they would have gotten on the U.S. planes. So the tariffs, the travel bans, all of that stuff is out the window. The way that I've seen this framed as sort of Petro caving in and, you know, giving Trump everything he wants, I don't think that's correct. I mean, his complaint was the way that the detainees were being treated, and so he ensured that the detainees would be treated better, and then agreed to accept the flights, as he has done with the deportation flights The whole while from Joe Biden, from the first, well, I mean, he wasn't around in the first Trump administration, but the Colombian government has accepted deportation flights from the U.S. is, you know, however far you want to go back. So it's not like he, you know, really caved in on that front, like just accepting the flights. It is, I guess, a little bit humiliating to have to send your own planes to the U.S. to pick up deportees from your country and bring them back. But, you know, on the basis that Petro was talking about this, I think he made his point and he got what he wanted.
Thank you, Derek. Let's do a quick hits U.S. round. And let's start with, man, we're doing great. Arms sales have hit a new record.
Yeah, we did it. We did it, folks. The U.S. State Department revealed this week that I think over the weekend or Friday maybe, that U.S. arms sales to foreign governments hit a record just under $320 billion last year. This is about $200 billion in direct sales from U.S. contractors, and then another $118 billion or so in sales arranged by the U.S. government. Most of that, I think, was driven by the war in Ukraine. And you know, maybe somebody wanted to get this on Donald Trump's desk because, of course, he loves arms deals. He loves selling weapons. He loves making money doing that. So if Ukraine is good for business in that regard, maybe he will continue to support Ukraine moving forward. Who knows? There was some, I mean, Israel obviously contributed to it to some degree, but the big driver, I think, was Ukraine.
And let's talk about this migrant detention facility that is being built or will be built perhaps at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba.
Trump announced this on Wednesday that he's got plans now to build a 30,000 capacity detention center at Guantanamo Bay to hold what he called the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people. And what the hell that means, I have no idea. But these are people who, again, according to him, are so bad we don't even trust the countries to hold them because we don't want them coming back. So, okay, I don't know. It sounds like a prison camp for people who are seeking asylum in the United States, which basically is what it may amount to. I don't know. But it's another case of Guantanamo Bay just giving generously to the cause of human rights and human development. I think, you know, we've made wonderful use of that space and should keep it for till the heat death of the universe, frankly.
Oh, I totally agree, Derek. We're a pro Guantanamo podcast. Let's end with the effects of Trump's foreign aid freeze.
Yes, Trump on Friday, I mean, Trump issued a freeze on foreign aid is one of his day one executive orders. But on Friday, the U.S. State Department put it into effect, froze almost all U.S. foreign aid, with the exception of military aid to Israel and to Egypt, but froze pretty much everything else. Now, it turned out after, I guess, some panic phone calls from the Ukrainian government, military aid to Ukraine is also unaffected. But everything else, as far as I know, was frozen. Now, on Tuesday, the administration issued, or the State Department issued, new guidance and a new exemption for humanitarian projects. So some of the things that the U.S. does, like its HIV treatment programs that it runs in, I think, for funds in something like 55 countries around the world. PEPFAR is the big piece of that, the program for Africa.
The Bush administration.
Right.
That's a good thing that Bush did.
Good thing that George Bush did in his life. So that program is still, was covered, I guess, by this humanitarian waiver. It's unclear how many other programs are going to be covered by it. And a lot of things are shutting down. I know there was a case of a number of hospitals or medical facilities that have been treating refugees from Myanmar who have gone across the border into Thailand are shutting down. They don't know if they're covered by the waiver, so they're continuing to shut these facilities down. And you know, in a number of other cases, kind of humanitarian projects are being reconsidered. And I'm sure many of them will not come back. There's supposed to be a 90-day review process for all of this all of these aid programs, and I think you can guarantee that anything that's focused on, let's say, women's health or LGBTQ, climate change, anything that isn't commensurate with the Trump administration's ethos will not be coming back. You know, I have seen, and I agree with, you know, comments on this that. Well, this is just kind of eliminating the contradictions in U.S. foreign policy by getting rid of the velvet glove that we put around the steel fist, which is true, certainly. You know, foreign aid is not done for any altruistic reasons. It's done for U.S. to serve U.S. national interests. And I get that. But it feels like just pulling the rug out from a lot of these programs without making any allowance for winding them down or anything like that is probably not the way to go about reforming this program, nor do
we want the Trump administration to do it.
Yes, Derek, certainly.
It is certainly the American way.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, it's not great for the people who depend on these programs, certainly, even if you think there may be a bigger picture here to it, which I agree with, you know, not good for the people who, let's say, need to go to the hospital in Thailand.
Yes, certainly not good for many people. And then this brute force fashion will always make things worse. Well, on that note, Derek, thank you as always. And to everyone else, keep on rocketing the free world. Bye.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials, and if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E, and you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.